the microphone.
Okay. We've seen some objectionable things about Aristotle's theory of the state. We've seen that it's collectivist, and as a consequence, it's totalitarian. There's no intrinsic limit here. There's nothing in the nature of the state that would limit its own ability to make laws about anything whatever, so it could cover the whole of life. And indeed, he thought it should. He thought that the state should tell people how to dress, what religion to have, what holidays to celebrate, and so on and on, and including dictate to them their religious beliefs. I've made specific objections along the way to the totalitarianism and to the specific consequences of it. But I've ended by saying that Christians everywhere, I think, universally see that slavery is a great evil, that they ought not to treat another human being that way, and it's utterly incompatible with the law of love. But I haven't sketched anything that would look like a Christian account of the state, an alternative theory to that of Aristotle, and that's what I want to do now. Let's take a look again at the way I represented his theory in a diagram. I put a crown up here to mean this is the ruling segment of the state. Whether this is a king, whether this is a committee, whether it's a legislature with a president or what it is, doesn't much matter. This is the ruling body. And then individuals are all parts of the state. They can't exist or function without the state, according to him. And then we have all sorts of other communities, the family, marriage, business, school. How about a labor union? Political party, art institutions of all kinds, maybe a band or an orchestra there, or something like that, and there are sports clubs and so forth. We have many kinds of institutions in society. There are many besides what fit in this little schema. We have charitable institutions dedicated to human health, such as a clinic or a hospital, a doctor's office. There are all sorts of things that he says are all included in the state. The state, which is the highest of all and includes all the rest, and therefore makes laws about them all. Now, that's one way to think about all this stuff. And this is a hierarchy of authority, with a supreme authority at the top, the authority of the state. Or let's say the authority is the authority of the government. That's the ruling body in the state. Okay, government. And this whole thing is the state. And it includes everything else, and therefore it aims at the highest good. What is that highest good? Well, according to Aristotle, it's happiness. That's what the state aims at. It aims at helping us to live a life that's virtuous, that's rational activity in accordance with virtue, and that will achieve a greater measure of happiness than if we didn't have the advantage of the state. So, how would a Christian go about construing the nature of the state and try to put it in its proper place instead of it encompassing all of life and being totalitarian? I think that would go something like this. this is the individual person, this dot in the center. And every individual person has many different sides and interests in their life. These are all natural. They arise just by being a human being. We're all interested in health, for example. We're all interested in making a living. We all express some kind of faith, religious belief, is the sense in which I'm using the term faith there. It's also the case that we all have some kind of interest in art. That may not be fine art. It may not be that we're wealthy enough to hang a Rembrandt on our wall or something. But there's style to our furniture. There's style to our clothes. We may arrange a garden to be beautiful. So there we got it back. Can't lose my illustrations here. Okay, we're all interested in education, that is, passing on what is learned by one generation to the next. We have an interest in that. And then there is erotic love. And then there is ethical love. And of course, we all have an interest in justice and in seeing an order of public justice established and maintained. These are just natural things, sides to life, things that arise in the course of living that we can't, any of us, avoid. And what humans do when they find that they have an interest that's important to them, they always make an institution to go along with it. So they embody this interest, protect that interest, by creating some sort of community or interest institution. So we call our interest in faith and in the divine, and we have an institution called a church. This could also be called a synagogue, a mosque, a temple. It doesn't matter in this case which religion that might be, but there's belief in divinity, and there's an institution for expressing it. We're all interested in protecting our health, and here we create clinics, hospitals. We're interested in making a living. This is what business is about. And in protecting that living, we may also form a labor union. We all have a natural interest in justice as well. And there is the institution of the state. Ethical love we express in charities, care of other people. Erotic love is expressed in marriage, in family. Education, we establish schools. Art, many artistic institutions, an orchestra, a band, an art colony, and so forth. This is orchestra. That's what that was supposed to say. I think you get the idea. The idea is that there are many different sides to our lives that naturally arise for all of us. We're not all interested equally in all of them. Some people are mad about art. Others go into the legal profession. And some are doctors. Some get a job in a business that they don't really, not really that interested in, but they're very interested in the life of their church or something like that. These are also not to be misunderstood as groups of people. These are natural interests that arise in life. That's what we have inside the circle. And outside the circle, the names of some of the institutions, communities we form, join, promote in order to maximize those interests. And this means that the state is one of many. It doesn't include all the others. It has its specific job, an order of public justice. It both establishes that, it both makes the laws, and it enforces the laws. One way to think of this is in terms of authorities and responsibilities. There are many different kinds of authorities in life. There's the authority of officials in the state. There's the authority of owners in a business, of doctors in a health practice, of clergy in a worship institution, of art masters in an artistic institution, of expert teachers in a school. There's the authority of parents in a family. And these are also all responsibilities that we have. We not only have distinct kinds of authorities, but the authority is for the very purpose of serving ourselves and others in intensifying and preserving all of these interests. So by interest here, I don't mean just somebody has money invested. Okay, that's not my point. I'm talking about sides to life that naturally arise for everyone and that everyone participates in to a lesser or greater degree. And then their interest corresponds then to the institution, the communities made to preserve and promote each of those natural interests. This is the view that I introduced before briefly and called sphere sovereignty. And it means that so far as the authority is concerned, there are many different kinds of them. So one person has authority in art, another's an expert on the law, another is a teacher in some field in which he or she has acquired an expertise and can teach. There's the authority of the clergy in an institution of worship, of the doctor in one of health, the authority of parents in the family, owners in the business. It goes on and on. There are many different kinds. And none of them is to be suppressed by any other. Each is to be allowed to have its own area in which its sovereignty and responsibility is respected by the others. That's a very different view of the nature of the state. It's not all-encompassing. The state does not embrace all the others and include them. The individual citizens aren't parts of a state. They're sub-wholes within a greater whole. And the state, by nature, by its own nature, is delimited to issues of public justice. Now, there may be a public justice side to almost any kind of issue that arises in society. That's true. But that doesn't extend the authority of the state beyond the public justice issue. Let me give an example. A concrete example of this would have been, let's say, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, child labor laws. There were none. And businesses were free to hire children for put them to work for nothing sometimes. You might think that's a strange hire, but this sort of thing did happen. I'm thinking of, let's say, a young widow who shows up with three children and wants a job in a sweatshop sewing. She has to take children with her because there's nowhere to leave them, nobody to mind them. Her husband's recently been killed on a job, and there's no insurance. She has to go to work, and she shows up, and she has the three kids with her. So the owner of the sweatshop says, I'll give you this job provided you continue to bring your kids every day and they work for nothing. That happened a lot in the U.S. That means that those children cannot get an education, cannot even attend church on Sunday if the owner demands that the mother and the children show up 7 days a week, and some of them did.
It means the destruction of family life as well. So that what I hear from, say, individualists often, they say, well, it's the individual's business. He has an absolute right over who he wants to hire. If he wants to insist on such terrible conditions, there's no legal ground to stop him. And the answer from the standpoint of view of sphere sovereignty is, yes, there is, because this is the right way to think of society. And the state, if it's to enforce justice, should take care of this mother and children, and should say to the owner, you cannot require somebody to spend their entire lives working for you. You cannot interfere with the education of the children. You cannot interfere with the worship of the family. And the family has to have some time of its own. That would be the just thing to do under the idea of sphere sovereignty. I read a novel not too long ago in which a man, now an older man, but as a young child, his family moved to the U.S. from Greece, and his parents were desperate to find work. His father finally got a job with a car manufacturing company. And they moved to the neighborhood, and they were overjoyed that he had this good job. And then delegates from the company came to their home. And they came in and said, this has to be an American home. This looks like the old country. You've got to get rid of this furniture. And what's that food we smell? That isn't American food. We smell garlic and other stuff that goes into Greek food. You've got to eat American food. And that music that's playing on your record player, that's Greek. We want American music. From the standpoint of sphere sovereignty, that's utterly outrageous. They can demand of that father that he do a good job on the job. And they can fire him if he doesn't. But they have no right whatsoever to tell his family how to live, what kind of food to eat, and what kind of music to listen to. That's outrageous. They're interfering into the realm of the family. They're interfering into the realm of the education of children. And I don't know I don't remember the young man being told what church to go to, but it's conceivable they could try that as well. Don't go to a Greek church. You've got to go to one where they speak English. That's none of their business. The business has an authority to make a judgment over his work for them when he's on that job. And when he's not on that job, they have nothing to say. Ownership on sphere sovereignty view is never absolute. Nobody ever absolutely owns anything that's totally theirs, such that no one else ever has any claim to it. That's made very clear in the scripture when God says, the land is mine. You're just using it. God's the one that owns all creation. We just get things entrusted to our use. And it's always in some limited fashion. Do the poor really have a claim on us? According to Scripture, they do. We have a moral obligation to support the poor, to create a safety net, not to let somebody starve in the street. If it's wrong for you and I to do that, as individuals, it's wrong for families, businesses, schools, states, and churches to do it, because the law of God applies to the whole of reality, not just individuals. Remember that point from last time. So here is an alternative view of the state altogether. Notice that this diagram is irrespective of exactly how you set the government up. This doesn't say that you can't have a king, or you can't have a limited monarchy, or you must have a parliamentarian system, or maybe it's ruled by a committee, an oligarchy. It doesn't go into the specific form the government may take, because it is saying this is the way to see the role of the state in the totality of human life, the role of the state in the totality of human society, irrespective of how you organize the authority of the state itself. It may be that some form of democracy is leads to the state being the most just that it can be. Or it might be some form of limited monarchy, where a monarch has certain powers, it's limited by the parliament or the lawmaking body, and other authoritative powers are distributed, say, to magistrates and judges or regional managers. It could be all kinds of different ways to organize it. But it's to see its authority as delimited to the matters of public justice only. Now, I'll hasten to add that even with thinking of things in the way this schema lays them out, doesn't solve every problem that could possibly arise. It's not a panacea for every ill or every controversy. It could be that people who believe this theory disagree with one another about exactly how to apply it, especially in borderline cases. Does this action fall under the authority of the state or under the authority of the school? And maybe it's a matter of what curriculum to have. Educators should, as experts, say what should be in the curriculum of every person in order to have a general, a common education. What's the core that they all need to know? They all need to know some literature, in history. They all need to be able to do mathematics and understand basic scientific concepts. I would just say that they all need to have logic. It's a favorite of mine to get into the curriculum. But there are a number of things that should be there for everybody. Should the authority of the state say, nobody, you must all go to this kind of school? The state's going to establish schools and you have to go to the state school. There's nothing wrong with the state establishing schools if it wishes, but there's something dead wrong about telling everyone that they have to go there and can't go anywhere else. Churches might build schools. A family grouping might build a school in their neighborhood. A business might have a school. Anybody can form one, support one. But what government or any other authority ought not to do is to dictate the curriculum or the criterion for graduation. That should be up to the experts in education who are hired by those schools. I think you get the drift of this. Even if I don't go into a great many examples. I think the example of the child labor is a good one, though, because it was the responsibility of the state to see to it that children were not taken advantage of. That is, they're not forced to work for no pay, and they're not forced to work such long hours and every day of the week as to rule out their education, their family life, and their religious life. It was the duty of the state to protect that. Now, I know that some people argued for child labor laws for other reasons. That would be a case in which the sphere of sovereignty view would agree about what needed to be done, but not for the same reasons. There were some individualists, for example, who argued that childhood should be a time of play and fun. And children should not be pressed to work. They're going to be working all the rest of their lives. Let them have fun now. They need recreation time. So it's to protect a kind of idealized notion of childhood that they want to see the child labor laws passed. I'm not here to debunk children having recreation and free playtime. I think they should have that. It's part of family life. But I don't find the objection to them working, to be the same as that one. That says children shouldn't be forced to work at all. But every child who grew up on a farm worked. They all had their chores from the time they were very small. There's nothing wrong with that. It didn't take the place of family life. It didn't usurp education. It didn't mean they couldn't go to church. It was just part of their life on the farm. Families are organized very differently, depending usually on how they make a living. If the father leaves the home and works in a factory and comes home, it's a different sort of home life from a farm family, where they all pitch in and do chores from the time they're small. That's very different, again, from a royal family, where no one does any sort of outside work, but has the cares of the state as their work and burden. They differ very much. And the law needs to respect that, too, that there are different sorts of families organized in different ways, different sorts of schools, different sorts of worship institutions, different kinds of art. The state is there to protect, with an order of public justice, all of these different institutions and all of the people that take part in them. And to do so as even-handedly as it possibly can. Now, I started to say that this view, I think, leads to a great more justice and a great and protects better than any other view I know, having the state run away with its power and extend it beyond its proper bounds. But it doesn't mean, as I started to say, that there will never be any disagreements. In borderline cases, people of goodwill, all of whom accept this view, may disagree about whether the authority in this case is on this side of a boundary line or the other, it's with this institution or the other. There can still be disagreements. But I think there will be fewer of them and less severe on this kind of idea than there would be if we were to adopt the hierarchical view, which isn't showing up for me now. Okay. Why not? Why won't it come back?
I think something gets tapped over here that turns it into a different
one.
So
no, I wanted to go back to this
there
one. There. Okay, now we got it. It's we're much less likely to have runaway authority of the state on the sphere of sovereignty view than on this hierarchical view, because here there are no intrinsic limits to the authority of the state at all. You start out by assuming that all other institutions are included and fall under the authority of the state. Well, then there's no limit to what are you going to appeal if you think the state has done an injustice. That, of course, is very different from this view, which at least starts out recognizing the integrity of other institutions in society, that each of them has its own kind of authority and its own responsibility within its own social sphere. One final comment about this. Some people find it very ironic that according to sphere sovereignty, it's the duty of the state, it's the duty of the government to make sure that it, along with all other institutions, never intrudes into an area that doesn't belong to it. In other words, it calls on the state to adjudicate disputes between other institutions, school, church, family, business, and so on, but also to restrain itself not to overextend its own power and to put limits on what it may do. Now, that idea of limited government has been kind of distorted in my country. There are a lot of people think that limited government means the smallest government you can have. No, it doesn't. It means limited in the scope of its authority. And what that means is that the government restrains itself. A good example of this, a laudable example of this, is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which begins, I quoted this before, "Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of religion." That's out of bounds. That's something that government may not do. We need more amendments like that. There are a lot more areas of life that need to be protected that way. Now, as I started to say, people are sometimes very skeptical that any government's really going to restrain itself in that manner. The answer to that is it depends on what the people believe. There is no ideology that guarantees that the people who favor it will live up to it. None. People who are thoroughly convinced and dedicated communists have been found to be compiling their own pile of treasure, secretly hidden away. They caved in and did everything that they weren't supposed to do. People who are sincere Christians have done terrible things as well. And so is the Christian church in history. And what I mentioned before about the treatment of heretics, for example. There's no ideology that guarantees the people who favor it will live up to it. We all cave to temptation at different times. But I think there are good examples of this idea of limited government being lived up to by the people who held it, and in some remarkable ways. And the example that comes to my mind is the example of the general who won independence for the United States, General George Washington. After the British colonies in America declared their independence, Washington took over as the commander of the army and was engaged in a life and death struggle for independence. Two times during that period, the Congress of the United States recognized that they were in an emergency situation and that they needed someone to take over the government and exercise dictatorial powers. So two times they conferred on Washington what they called emergency dictatorial powers. That meant, in the extreme, Washington could order anybody executed with no trial. But they knew what Washington believed. They knew what he was fighting for and what he was committed to. And they were right about him. He didn't abuse those powers. And when he judged that the emergency was passed, he wrote a letter back to the Congress and rescinded, gave them back these dictatorial powers. That's an example of getting the kind of government that you believe in. He believed in limited government. He believed in some truncated version, at least, of sphere sovereignty without ever knowing the name. He believed that even though he had to be given dictatorial powers temporarily, that was temporarily, only temporary and for an emergency, and he gave them back. And when Washington died, George III of England, against whom he had pulled off this successful revolution and rebellion, called him the greatest man in the world because he had absolute power and willingly given it up. George should know he was tempted to exercise power beyond what he was rightfully entitled to himself, and he knew the temptation. And to have been given it all and then turn around and give it back, he acknowledged as a remarkable feat of virtue on Washington's part. So I wanted to cover this much because it's not only that we have objections to Aristotle's totalitarian vision of government, to his making everything included under the state, and everything falling under the state authority over the entirety of life, no limits. Well, there's also another theory of the state that we can point to, and here it is on your screen. It's not totalitarian, and it strives to differentiate authorities and responsibilities in the different aspects of life as they are distributed and embodied in the different communities and institutions of society. Then, this concludes our contrast of a Christian view of the state, and I commend again to you the reading so that you'll be prepared for the exams.